You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Bone Collector by Josh Sanborn, with illustrations by Leonardo Santamaria. Miller got his ham radio license in 1943, founded his own electronics company called Wyman Research, and helped develop slow scan TV, a technology that transmits still images across high-frequency radio bands. In 1972, he was honored as Amateur of the Year by a ham radio convention and later helped get SSTV aboard the Mir space station, building the system that beamed back images of Earth in December 1998. Bolt remembers Miller as a walking, talking encyclopedia, fond of green-checked sport jackets and a giant ceramic coffee cup emblazoned with a Navy seal. At lunch, they talk about how societies evolved, history, civilizations, or Miller's own expeditions. Miller often took a couple weeks vacation each year to go on a dig, Bolt says. One time, Miller told Bolt that he drove to Mexico with his wife and asked the locals about nearby ruins. While he was driving, he ran a red light, refused to pay the fine, and was jailed. After a day and a half, he and his wife waited until the main jailers were away, with only the lowest-ranking officer watching them. Miller's wife faked abdominal pains, and when the officer checked on her, they threw him on their cot, locked him in their cell, got in their car, and drove off. "I suspect he's still a wanted man down there," Bolt said. Another time, Miller told Bolt he was traveling through western Egypt looking for ruins and ended up in eastern Libya, where he saw Libyan troops pop up over the hills. He said he'd been accused by Muammar Gaddafi's government of being a CIA agent and was detained for a day before being released. Amy Moore accompanied Miller on one of those expeditions, a Christian mission trip to Haiti, where they traveled from one end of the country to the other, helping build churches and schools. During the trip, they visited the Cité de la Ferrière, a 19th-century fort and UNESCO World Heritage Site. On the way home, airport security stopped Miller. They found small musket shots in his carry-on luggage. "They took it and kind of made a whoop-de-doo about that," Moore said, "but they didn't look in his checked bags, where Miller had packed a larger cannonball." He later told Moore, "If you can divert security on one item, you can get something else by them, something better." He baited them, Moore said. Late in 2013, Carpenter contacted Holly Cusack McVeigh, an anthropologist he knew at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Cusack McVeigh has been interested in Native cultures since elementary school. When she announced to her parents she was going to be an anthropologist, they laughed. "You need a lot of degrees for that," they said. A few years later, when she was in middle school, she was walking through the woods near their cabin in Canada when she saw the bones of two young women and an infant in the dirt. "I saw them eroding out of the side of the embankment," Cusack McVeigh said. She'd inadvertently discovered a burial ground. They were Anishinaabe, a group of culturally related indigenous peoples who often reside in the Great Lakes region. While other kids were at summer camp, Cusack McVeigh was working with the Canadian government and tribal authorities on how to preserve the remains. And her parents realized their daughter might be serious about anthropology. Next illustration, the FBI operation involved more than 100 people, including evidence recovery teams, archaeologists, and tribal authorities. We looked a little bit like an army. Cusack McVeigh often works with tribes on repatriating native remains that have been illegally excavated, a noxious practice that's been occurring since the arrival of Europeans in the New World. White settlers were often curious about people perceived as the other, so curious that they sometimes dug up their bodies, mistreated sacred sites and burial grounds in the process. But the golden age of grave robbing began in the 1800s, when people increasingly compiled cabinets of curiosities. The stranger the items in their eyes, the better. Indigenous populations were largely not seen as human, Cusack McVeigh says. In some cases, they were seen as collectible. The practice coincided with the emergence of racist scientific theories asserting that behavioral attributes could be discovered through physical characteristics like skull size. In the early to mid-1800s, Samuel Morton, considered the father of American anthropology, collected and analyzed a vast number of skulls. He said proved that cranial size was a marker of intelligence, with whites at the top, blacks at the bottom, and Native Americans in the middle. By 1867, the U.S. Surgeon General ordered Army personnel to collect Native American skulls for the Army Medical Museum, later determining that American Indians must be assigned a lower position on the human scale than has been believed heretofore. Around the turn of the century, another unfounded notion took hold, the myth of the vanishing Indian, a belief that indigenous peoples in the Americas were dying out. Emerging museums and institutions rushed to compete for native artifacts. Today, according to Smithsonian Magazine, an estimated 500,000 Native American remains sit in museums around the U.S. A similar figure resides in museums across Europe. While the origins of roughly 116,000 sets of remains and 1 million funerary items in U.S. museums are unknown. Dr. Bill Billick, head of the Repatriation Office at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History, says that since the late 1980s, a series of federal laws, along with shifting attitudes about the origins of some of its holdings, have pushed the museum to re-examine its Native American collection. Since then, roughly 220,000 artifacts and 6,300 human remains have been marked as available for repatriation. Two-thirds have been returned. But institutions weren't the only ones amassing collections. After World War II, amateur clubs and state archaeology societies took off. Amateur archaeology, Carpenter says, became a kind of national pastime. People would go out and have picnics and dig up Indian graves, he says, without any true ethical examination of the practice. Too often, Cusack McVeigh says, the person who dug graves for sport would also be the type to visit the cemetery after church and place flowers on the graves of their own ancestors. In January 2014, with Cusack McVeigh on board to help identify Miller's items, Carpenter calls Jake Archer, an FBI agent who'd recently joined the art theft program. Archer describes himself as a very proud Jersey boy who grew up ambling the Jersey shore while watching his grandfather, a local pen and ink artist, draw and sketch. Archer attended law school before joining the FBI, then went to graduate school at Rutgers University, studying art history, cultural heritage, and preservation. His thesis, the care of art and artifacts in the hands of law enforcement. He was exactly the person Carpenter needed. Carpenter was driving back from Washington, D.C., having just briefed the FBI's executive director about the case when he rang Archer. He heard an excited, fast-talking agent from the East Coast on the other end. Archer heard Rockytop, Tennessee. Carpenter told Archer about Miller and the possibility that he possessed tens of thousands of artifacts. That's when I had a chill run up, Archer said. Next illustrations. Agents found 2,000 bones, mostly Native American, hidden on the property. During the raid, the Pokagon band of Potawatomi performed a cleansing ceremony for the dead. And my apologies for that initial mispronunciation. Archer became Carpenter's partner, tasked with developing a plan for seizing the items. One of the primary concerns was damage. Take, say, a clay-fired pot buried 4,000 years ago in a tomb. It survived earthquakes and natural disasters, was dug up thousands of years later, tossed in a truck, driven thousands of miles across the country, and placed inside a basement for half a century, only to have the FBI come along and drop it in Miller's driveway. The agents couldn't walk in and start shoving things in boxes. They had to think through each artifact's journey from Miller's basement into the FBI's hands before they even encountered it, all while taking into account temperature and humidity conditions, inclement weather, and ultimately where it would all be stored. Most collections, when moved, are allowed to slowly acclimate to environmental conditions. The FBI wouldn't have that luxury. The agents would have to rapidly assess, collect, transport, and store a museum's worth of priceless artifacts within a matter of days. To prepare, Archer toured the Princeton University Art Museum back in New Jersey. But rather than examine its exhibits, he visited the museum's storage. He walked through its long rows of gray, utilitarian metal shelving, holding thousands of items, trying to envision what it would be like to encounter Miller's collection in real time. He asked the museum's directors how long it would take to move it all. Months, they told him. One way they could speed up the process would be to obtain Miller's consent, and Carpenter believed that he could convince Miller to voluntarily give up his life's work. He thought Miller ultimately knew what he'd done was wrong, and that the items should be returned. If he refused to cooperate, the FBI would need a search warrant. But that presented its own problems. Some of the agency's attorneys argued that Carpenter would need to establish probable cause on every single item, even though there were countless artifacts for which Carpenter hadn't obtained evidence or even seen. Miller, for example, told Carpenter about an Anasazi pot Carpenter believed was illegal. But Miller had hundreds of Anasazi pots, and Carpenter didn't have specific information on those, only the one. Establishing probable cause on each would be unreasonable and essentially impossible. Instead, Carpenter argued that Miller's collection was commingled, meaning the FBI could seize a whole set of pots based on evidence of one. After back and forth with the Department of Justice, Carpenter won out. The complicated web of laws applying to the collection was another matter, the oldest of which is the Antiquities Act of 1906, which restricts excavation of archaeological sites or gathering objects of antiquity to permitted institutions like museums or universities. But that rarely stopped amateur diggers. It wasn't until 1979 that Congress passed the Archaeological Resources Protection Act, specifically protecting artifacts on public and Indian lands. In 1990, Congress passed the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, or NAGPRA, protecting indigenous gravesites. But Miller's collection was so vast that numerous other laws also likely applied. The Abandoned Shipwreck Act, protecting wreck sites. State laws, especially in the Southwest, that make it a crime to steal artifacts. The National Stolen Property Act, a federal law that applies to stolen items transported across state lines. And various patrimony laws in other countries that protect a nation's own artifacts. The morning of the operation, Carpenter and Archer showed up at the Indianapolis field office to see their plan in physical form. Semi-trucks, mobile RVs, generators, tents, evidence recovery teams, outside experts, dozens of agents, and even tribal authorities. More than 100 people altogether. They left the office in a snaking caravan and drove south. "We looked a little bit like an army," Carpenter said. When they got close, the caravan staged at a truck stop while a handful of agents approached Miller's house first. Carpenter carried the 100-page search warrant, hoping he wouldn't have to use it. They arrived around 9 a.m. Walking to the door, Archer looked up to see the life-size terracotta warrior. "If something this big is out here," he thought, "what am I going to find inside?" Carpenter tapped Archer on the shoulder, snapping him back. "You're the lawyer," Carpenter said with a grin. "You're in charge of obtaining consent." Miller opened the door. This time, Carpenter was in a suit, ringed by other agents. They sat down in Miller's living room. Carpenter told him the FBI had reason to believe much of his collection was obtained illegally, and they wanted to take possession of his illicit items, especially any human remains. They brought up Miller's time with the military, the story of his life he told people, stressing that his collection could jeopardize that legacy. They wanted to return the artifacts with his permission. Miller got his lawyer on the phone. After about an hour, he consented. They could take whatever they wanted. Carpenter told Miller there was a massive team down the road. "It'll look a bit scary," he said, and offered Miller and his wife the option to stay in a hotel. They declined. As the caravan arrived, Miller gave the agents a full tour. He took them into the basement, where Archer saw the collection he'd been imagining for months. It made him dizzy. Then they entered the other buildings on the property. They started finding boxes of artifacts that appeared to have been sitting around for decades. Some were covered in dirt, others infested with mice, rats, insects, feces. Then Miller took them into a locked room underneath the white farmhouse. Archer saw a brown shopping bag. Inside were 8 skulls. 3 more sat on a shelf. They found a garbage bag full of bones, and as they looked inside, a raccoon came flying out. Miller ushered them through a tunnel full of standing water that led to the Wyman Research Building, where agents saw dozens of blue and green tote bins. They were full of human remains, many haphazardly thrown together. Some were infants and toddlers. On one shelf, a dozen skulls sat lined up, impacted with red soil in various states of repose. Miller said he'd excavated them 5 years earlier in New Mexico from an unmarked burial site. "He was so proud of those," Carpenter said. "It was his last dig," he told them. Carpenter noticed Miller only had the skulls and asked where the bodies were. "We left those there," Miller said. In the barn, agents found more bags of bones and skulls, some that had sat there for 50 years, never opened. Inside the main residence, in a basement closet, were 2 dozen more skulls on shelves, some with arrowheads sticking out of them. They also found a skeleton in a display case Miller said was Crazy Horse, a Lakota Native American who was buried in an unknown location. He didn't want anyone touching it, Carpenter said. It would not be seen by the Cub Scouts or the typical visitor. It was something extra, something special. Miller, it seemed, was only comfortable showing off parts of his collection. It was the parts that were PG, Archer said. Outside, the FBI constructed a small village. They unloaded generators, ATVs, and lumber from flatbed semis. Archer began setting up a series of climate-controlled, pressurized tents where items could be safely handled and processed. Agents, archaeologists, anthropologists, uniformed police, and tribal officials swarmed the grounds. Photographers shot everything in situ. And they found stuff everywhere. You open up a kitchen drawer, and there's a stone flint piece in there that just somehow made its way in there that he's forgotten about for the last 30 years, Carpenter said. In one room, they found an old cigar box full of loose teeth. As the outside experts took in the scope of the collection, some got emotional. Carpenter witnessed career anthropologists crying, some upset over the remains, others just overwhelmed. At one point, Carpenter was looking at a case of stone axes with an archaeologist who specialized in Celtic cultures. He said, I've spent my entire career looking for just one of these in this condition, Carpenter said, and he has 50. Another expert told Archer that Miller's artifacts from the Taino people in Haiti were better than the Metropolitan Museum of Arts. Meanwhile, Carpenter and Archer tried to get as much information out of Miller as possible. He told them that beginning in the 1950s, he and his first wife would go out looking for potsherds, often a sign that a burial ground was nearby. Then they'd start digging. The agents learned that Miller sometimes used his business, Wyman Research, to write off trips to places with ham radio operators, including countries like Haiti, where he would build churches the first part of the week, dig the second part, and write the whole thing off as a business expense. It allowed him to obtain visas to places that might have been difficult to enter otherwise. In foreign countries, they learned Miller often gave locals a bottle of alcohol or carton of cigarettes in exchange for the locations of unmarked archaeological sites. He would gain their trust and provide something, Archer said. In return, he would take from them their cultural property. What started out as a hobby seemed to grow into something much bigger, a monster Miller couldn't contain. Don did tell me very specifically one day that this was a heroin addiction to him, Carpenter said, that he just couldn't stop. The bulk of the FBI seizure began the second day. Archer, who developed a 102-degree fever from mold exposure in Miller's waterlogged tunnel, kept a stopwatch. His goal was 500 items seized a day. Experts helped make rapid assessments of each. This looks Assyrian. This is Peruvian. These are Roman. For the items deemed illegal, Cusack McVeigh's graduate students helped write the description of each on an archival card, then carried it upstairs for packaging. The human remains skipped photography and were handled separately. At one point, Miller got agitated and asked Carpenter, "Why are you taking all of my Indians?" Carpenter reminded him that the priority was locating and removing all of the remains. He's like, yeah, okay. I just don't understand why you're taking my Indians, Carpenter said. He reminded Miller that these were people who he'd personally dug up and brought home, trying to convey the sensitivities of what he'd done while keeping in mind that the FBI was operating with Miller's consent, which he could revoke at any time, potentially jeopardizing the entire operation. He said, well, if it's just a bunch of dead Indians that make you squeamish, then go ahead and take them, Carpenter told me. It was the only time, Carpenter says, he lost his cool. He told Miller if that's how he felt, he wouldn't mind if he visited the cemetery and dug up his grandparents. Miller got angry and walked away. At the beginning, Carpenter says Miller watched the agents as they carted off his collection. But soon he got tired and wasn't seen much. He stayed in parts of the house where the FBI wasn't. After several days, agents believed they had seized all of the human remains, including the ones underneath the Wyman Research Building, where they found roughly half of Miller's collection of bones. We pulled a couple hundred people out of that room, Carpenter said. As the last set of remains was removed, tribal officials from the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians, the closest federally recognized tribe, performed a cleansing ceremony in Miller's yard. They burned vegetation and said prayers for the ancestors whose spiritual journey had been disrupted. I don't know who you are yet, but you are going home, Cusack McVeigh remembers one of the elders saying. Miller didn't attend. On the sixth day, April Midwestern showers arrived and turned Miller's yard into a giant puddle. Carpenter's truck sank in the mud, and a cold front was threatening. By then, the FBI had seized 2,000 bones and 5,000 cultural artifacts and funerary objects out of a total collection of 42,000 items. My Kentucky windage was pretty close, Carpenter says. The agents believed they'd seized the majority of the obviously illicit items. So they dismantled their village, took down their tents, and packed up. Archer was the last to leave. As he walked to his car, he felt the cold front coming. He got in, shut the door, and sensed the change of air pressure, the compressed silence. He looked back at the terracotta warrior on Miller's front porch. The FBI didn't take it. It was granite, fake, nothing of real value. This time it looked a lot smaller. The FBI seizure made national news. Many in Rush County, especially those who knew Miller, weren't happy. Amy Moore calls the FBI operation an atrocity. It was awful that they did that to him, and in his old age, Moore said. Many people I talked to who knew Miller believed he had obtained his artifacts legally and often had permits to dig, or that he had excavated much of his collection before laws came on the books protecting those items. I think a lot of people were offended, says John Wilson, Rush County's historian. He says many residents believed Miller was a good man who served his country and hadn't done anything wrong. 2 months after the operation, the Shelby County Historical Society's Grover Museum displayed some of Miller's collection left behind by the FBI. We're just really fortunate to have our friend, Don Miller, loan us these things after all he went through, Candy Miller, the museum's director and no relation to Don, told a reporter at the time. In 2015, the Indiana Archaeological Society awarded Miller a Lifetime Achievement Award, saying Miller was the very definition of someone dedicated to archaeological advancement. Jeff Pyle, a society member who met Miller after the operation, told me he'd heard the reason the FBI showed up was to secure an atomic bomb detonator and that the artifact's seizure was merely to cover the agency's tracks. After the operation, Miller turned reclusive. Frank Densler, then working as a reporter for the Rushville Republican, tried to interview him, but Miller never spoke about the seizure publicly. You didn't see him around town anymore, Densler said. An hour north, in the Indianapolis field office's parking lot, Miller's former collection sat inside a 53-foot refrigerated truck in temperatures of 30 degrees below zero. Carpenter had reached out to several museums for help, storing the items and freezing them to eliminate insects and pests, but none would talk to him. Nobody had the facilities to support us for something this large, he said. Eventually, the collection was moved to a commercial warehouse in an undisclosed location. Cusack McVeigh's graduate students were tasked with maintaining the items. The agents, meanwhile, began sorting through a whole other collection they'd seized. 18,000 photos, hundreds of hours of home movies, and roughly 20 passports. Trying to piece together more than 60 years of Miller's travels, they were shocked by what they saw. Videos and photos taken by Miller and Sue show the two of them digging in the Dakotas, Mexico, South America, and elsewhere, often in remote areas. In one video, Miller, with an ear-to-ear smile, is shoving a skull into a brown bag as other bones sit nearby. In South Dakota, Miller is lying in a recently dug grave. A photo from Mexico shows a child's casket. Another photo, taken in Papua New Guinea, shows piles of bones and skeletons. A bulldozer can be seen in the background. In another, Sue is kneeling next to a giant pile of white and gray pottery shards. Another shows a skull near a father-daughter burial crypt in New Orleans Miller had excavated. In one image, a skull is sitting inside a kitchen oven. Carpenter says Miller would clean the skulls, preserve them with varnish or shellac, and bake them so they would harden and turn brown. A video clip shows Miller and others at a burial cave on Easter Island, one of the world's most famous archaeological sites, bringing out skulls and other remains, grinning while tossing the skulls into a bag. And in one of the most disturbing shots, a Native American skull, cut in half, is filled with yellow apples. Until now, the FBI has never shared any of these images. I want to dispel the notion that Don was a responsible collector, Carpenter says. He was not. He was a grave robber. The passports, which had either expired over the years or been completely filled with stamps, showed Miller had visited about 100 countries. But Carpenter says agents didn't find any evidence that Miller was ever permitted to dig. The FBI also examined the items with the more extraordinary backstories. Carpenter says the atomic bomb detonator Miller told people about was, in fact, a radio communication system, which wasn't seized and has been cleared by the government. But Carpenter added that it appeared to be the same radio unit seen with Miller in photos at Los Alamos. The agents analyzed skulls pierced with arrowheads and determined that Miller hammered in those arrowheads himself. The skeleton Miller said was Crazy Horse was actually several people. Miller had taken pieces from other skulls, a different mandible, someone else's teeth and bones, and glued it all together, Frankenstein-like. Miller, it turns out, was a stager. He thought less like an archaeologist and more like a storyteller, just like he created his entire persona, Archer said. Earlier this year, I asked the Los Alamos National Laboratory for any documents related to Don Miller's time with the Manhattan Project. The laboratory found only one, a single-page form that describes Miller's role as assisted Higginbotham in the design of scaling integration discriminators, built 10-channel discriminator for Trinity analysis levels. Higginbotham is William Higginbotham, who headed the Manhattan Project's electronics group and witnessed the Trinity explosion. An official at the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History, which preserves Manhattan Project records collected by the Atomic Heritage Foundation, told me, "It appears that Miller built equipment that gathered data from the Trinity test, which matches up with his work later in life building radio and communications devices. What the document did not say is that Miller fired the first atomic bomb, or sent the signals for it to explode. In fact, according to the Foundation, the person who actually flipped the switch for Trinity was a man named Joe McKibben. And when I first reached out about Miller, the museum had no record of him. A year after the operation, Miller waived title on the items seized by the FBI, essentially acknowledging he no longer possessed them. That prevented the FBI from litigating the material in court through forfeiture proceedings, speeding up the repatriation process by a decade. A few days later, Miller died. There seemed to be little will at the Department of Justice to prosecute Miller, who was 91, for what was tantamount to property crimes. But his death ended any possibility of criminal charges. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Indianapolis declined to comment. Similarly, the FBI would not discuss whether his widow, Sandra, was under investigation. But it appears that Miller did not engage in illegal excavating while they were married, and Carpenter said she was cooperative during the operation. For the last 7 years, the FBI has been trying to repatriate the items it seized. The agency sent letters to every federally recognized tribe in the U.S., alerting them to the possibility that Miller owned artifacts or remains that might be theirs. Carpenter had difficult conversations with tribal officials about arrowheads being hammered through skulls and bones in horrifying conditions. It took anthropologists a year to separate the 2,000 bones and determine they comprised about 500 people. Early on, experts determined through osteological analysis and items found with remains that some were from the MHA nation, which includes the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara peoples. In 2016, Carpenter, Cusack McVeigh, and FBI agent Drew Northern drove the remains to the Crow Creek Reservation in central South Dakota. The bones arrived wrapped in red cloth, an honor color, and were carried to a mass grave, where tribal elders sang prayers, assuring their spirits would no longer be agitated and could return to their ancestral villages. They offered food to the dead, corn soup, fry bread, June berries. That day, they reburied dozens of bones belonging to about 30 people that had sat in boxes in Miller's house for years. Cusack McVeigh and the two agents stood at the grave, along with Pete Coffey, an MHA Nation tribal official who helped repatriate them. Coffey told me he hopes his efforts in this life will aid him in the next one. All the people he reburied that day, he said, will be there to help him when his time comes. Almost two-thirds of the items seized have been returned to Canada, Cambodia, Mexico, Ecuador, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, Spain, and elsewhere. In 2019, more than 300 artifacts, including artwork, jewelry, and vases, were repatriated to China, the largest ever repatriation from the U.S. Last year, more than 450 items were returned to Haiti. Haitian officials told Carpenter no one's ever repatriated anything to their country. But so far, only some of the human remains have been returned, in part because it's proven so difficult for the FBI and others to determine where they came from. The bones were often jumbled inside bags and bins, with few clues to their origins. In the end, the FBI will likely have 300 to 400 individuals, mostly Native Americans, who won't be properly linked to a specific tribe or region. The Pokagon Band of Potawatomi has agreed to bury the native remains in a mass grave in Indiana. The seizure of Miller's collection was the single largest recovery of cultural property in FBI history and the biggest case of Carpenter's career. In 2016, he was promoted to lead the art theft program in Washington, D.C. Carpenter says Miller got away with illegally digging for decades, not only because he was highly intelligent and knew how to evade law enforcement, but also because these types of crimes aren't a priority in the U.S. It's unclear how many human remains are in private hands today. Crimes related to Native American cultural objects have gone down starkly, Carpenter says, but it's still an ongoing problem. He expects to hear about more problematic private collections over the years as they're handed down to younger generations more troubled by them. Miller is buried at the Moscow Cemetery, near the home where he first collected arrowheads as a boy. Land once populated by the Delaware tribe of Indians, before they were uprooted and pushed west under the guise of science and progress. Divine providence and manifest destiny. The back of Miller's brown tombstone lists his accomplishments and hobbies as amateur radio, archaeology, travel. Years ago, Amy Moore's parents died and were cremated, and she remembers that Miller disapproved. He said, "You need to be buried and embalmed," Moore told me. She doesn't know for sure, but she suspects Miller was buried with part of his collection. "People need to be able to find you," he once told her, 100 years from now.
Thank you.
now this by Brett Hinemuth, Mavericks, with photos by Nick Riley Bentham, styled by Rebecca Ramsey. A new generation of pilots gets its wings in Tom Cruise's long-awaited sequel to Top Gun. Opening photo shows Jay Ellis, Monica Barbaro, Danny Ramirez, Glenn Powell, and Lewis Pullman horsing around on the Paramount back lot. 3 years ago, Tom Cruise set out to cast a new generation of magnetic and chiseled pilots for Top Gun Maverick, the highly anticipated sequel scheduled to land on Memorial Day weekend next year. After scouring young Hollywood, he found his squad. Glenn Powell, Jay Ellis, Lewis Pullman, Danny Ramirez, Monica Barbaro, playing the first female pilot featured in the franchise, and Miles Teller. Cruise and director Joseph Kosinski wanted real stunts with cameras capturing actual flight patterns. So the star curated the training he wished he'd had back in 1986. In anyone else's hands, Top Gun is a CGI movie, says Powell. Only Tom puts real actors in real planes. The aircraft were flown by pilots, but the cast were in the cockpit for such long, intense stretches that sometimes they had to do what they had to do. I peed in the plane a few times, says Ellis. I peed in the plane almost every time, says Pullman. The actors trained for 3 months in a progression of aircraft, then did maintenance flights for G-force tolerance. Tom would go first, says Ellis, and then we'd have to go up there and just try to keep up with what he just did. Fans of the original Top Gun's immortal beach volleyball scene will be relieved to hear that our new heroes find time to play shirtless football on the sand. The younger actors worked out and skipped carbs for months to prep and did some last-second moisturizing so their muscles would glisten. I was eventually cut off from the baby oil, says Powell. After sunset, the cast celebrated with wings, tater tots, and beer, but later learned they had to shoot the scene again. We were devastated, Ellis says with a laugh. Moviegoers everywhere will thank them for their service. Last Dance, when Ashley Byers and Doug Benfield met on the 2016 Trump trail, it was a coup de foudre for the two gun enthusiast evangelicals. 4 years later, their passion project, a ballet company for unconventional dancers, would be in shambles, and one of them would be dead. By Alice Robb, with the illustrations by James Taylor Gray. On an unseasonably hot day in the fall of 2017, four dozen dancers descended on the small city of Charleston, South Carolina. Seasoned soloists from major companies, as well as students fresh out of dance school, they were lucky members of the newly formed American National Ballet. Their new jobs, they believed, represented not only the fulfillment of their own dreams, but a revolution in the field of ballet. A&B's husband and wife founders, businessmen Doug Benfield and Ashley Benfield, herself a former dancer, appeared to have deep pockets and a noble mission: to highlight racially diverse and physically unconventional dancers. Their first hire was Sarah Michelle Murawski, a stunning 5'10" dancer who said she had lost her previous job because of her above-average height. "I want dancers who aren't the cookie-cutter dancers," Ashley had told Murawski, who started crying and when they hung up thought, "This is really what I want to do." At 5'9", Ashley said that she had dealt with similar obstacles in her own career. Another recruit was then 20-year-old Hannah Manka, who had the opposite problem and usually fudged her barely 5 feet on her resume. The offer from the Benefields was a lifeline. As Manka recalls, "After working so hard and trying for so long, I was like, oh my gosh, all this work finally has paid off." A&B pledged to redress not only height and size discrimination, but the notorious whiteness of classical ballet. Each new hire, at the behest of their new bosses, posted a photo on Instagram with a hashtag, hashtag We Embrace Diversity, or hashtag A&B Family. Christopher Charles McDaniel had spent years as the only black dancer at Los Angeles Ballet before deciding to join A&B. "There was so much hope for what could happen with this new company," he said. "And in a world where even the most established companies struggle for funding, A&B seemed to have no shortage of cash." The fledgling troupe, 47 dancers in all, reportedly had an annual budget of $2.5 million, and its dancers were promised 8-month contracts, health insurance, and, for those who had been recruited from Germany or Argentina or Estonia, American visas. The dancers had been urged to sign year-long leases at a luxury apartment complex that boasted flat-screen TVs and free tanning beds. "The best part, you can see the main studios from the apartments," wrote an A&B administrator. "Not even a 2-minute walk." This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.